This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Tech John episode 08. We've got a bit of a different vibe this week as we interview Professor Tanya M. Evans, crypto expert and host of the Tech Intersect podcast. But first, we kick off the show with the dad tax on Halloween candy and a couple of tech stories. From Columbus, Ohio, I'm your host, Rob Dunwood.
And coming out of Philly, it's your girl, Tech Life's Death.
And coming out of Atlanta, this is Terrence Gaines, a.k.a. Brother Tech.
I'm excited, y'all. We got our first guest. We did a live stream last week. We got a guest this week. We are cooking with gas legit on the Tech John podcast.
Straight legit.
So, y'all had good weeks?
Yep. I had to institute the yearly dad tax when it comes to the Halloween candy. So, you know, we did, of course, you know, I've got younger kids, so they did the Halloween thing. This is the first time in years, actually, I've been off for Halloween. Normally, I'm the one schlepping the kids around the neighborhood because first couple years, my wife was pregnant. And then just after that, you know, just circumstance had me out there. So this is the first week I got to sit around the house and even super off because my daughter, she's at that age to where she's like, yeah, I'm too old for trick or treating. So
that was never a thing for me. I was like, I'm too old. What you mean? I'm too old.
I think I was like 26 the last time I stopped going, but you know, I'm just
free candy.
Yeah. So peer pressure, whatever. She actually manned the candy. So when the kids came to knock on the door, she was the one dishing out candy. So I actually got to sit in my family room and catch up on sports. So that's what I did for Halloween. Like I said, when the kids got home, I instituted the dad tax. And had to make sure I get my cut.
That's right.
For the kids to get to partake. So it was a good weekend for me.
But this is a tech show, so we probably should go ahead and talk about some tech. And Terrence, you actually popped a story in our notes that, you know, really piqued my ear because I know and have a lot of family members who are truck drivers. So why don't you tell us about the first autonomous EV that's going to be hitting the States here?
Well,
or I should say autonomous truck.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring this in as more of a question more than anything, but I want to give some context. So I read a story about the first autonomous electric vehicle freight truck to hit the U.S. courtesy of a partnership between General Electric and a Swedish manufacturer called Einride. I'm going to say Einride. Basically they have created this partnership. They're going to bring these pod trucks to GE's 750-acre appliance park in Louisville, Kentucky, before expanding to other sites in Tennessee and Georgia. And of course, they've got a statement about, you know, how these remote operated pod systems are being installed in scale and how they're going to reduce environmental footprint and how they're going to do all this worldwide technology, yada, 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 so on and so forth. So I guess I just wanted to ask the question, even though we've got Tesla doing autopilot and we've got companies like, I think, Waymo. Is one of the companies.
And Zook is another one.
Right. They're trying to do not only just autonomous, you know, personal vehicles, but autonomous commercial and fleet vehicles. I guess I just wanted to ask the question, is autonomous, not just electric vehicles, because I kind of know that that's going to be the future, but autonomous vehicles, do you think autonomous vehicles are going to take off so much so to where they start to supplant or even take the place of actual drivers. Especially, I wanted to bring that up because of this whole truck driver shortage. Now, I know autonomous vehicles are not going to be able to help this current issue with being a lack of truck drivers. But do you really think autonomous vehicles, when the next truck driver shortage comes up, will you think that that will actually be a viable option? Or is this just a wishful thing to where maybe down the road, but we'll still need regular drivers?
I don't see regular drivers ever going away. And I don't even know how much these vehicles will replace. I think human nature being what it is, people are not going to want to give up their cars the same way they don't want to give up their guns. Mm-hmm. But also I think it's still going to take years and years and years of AI training, for any of these vehicles to truly be safe on the roadway. But I don't know that there is enough AI training to account for the other cars on the road for an autonomous vehicle to be safe enough with other drivers. Cause we've all been on 95 and the way folks cut those trucks off and they're all, you know, all pissed cause they're going too slow or they get on a hill and slow down and then people are tailgating so it's just like, I believe that had we not had the human factor in there, it could work, but the fact that you'd have those trucks on the road with other human drivers, mm-hmm. I think that's going to be the sort of sticking point in getting these vehicles on the road safely.
Now, I think for these particular trucks that are coming to GE from Einride, they're going to be, and I think they call it like level one and level two. So these are going to be driving around GE's massive
right.
complex is like seven. I think it's like the complex that's going to get it first is like 780 acres or something like that. So it's well over, you know, square mile and a half that, these trucks are just going to be driving on the actual campus and maybe short jaunts on public access roads in between facilities. Like they may have to like drive out of a lot, get on a road that actual people drive on, go, you know, a couple hundred meters and then, you know, turn in and you know, go back into the plant. So I believe that these are only,
and for that application, I think it's perfect.
Right. Right. And I think they only have like a range of like 110 miles. So these are definitely not long haul. These are to move stuff around in relatively close distances to each other. Mm-hmm. Now, to answer the other part of your question. So I think autonomous vehicles are going to take off more so with trucks than they will with cars, at least more quickly. And that's just because people are just going to be resistant to I like driving my car. Like my grandfather, way back in the day, my grandfather he would cut the seatbelts out of his car. I want to be thrown clear. Right. And it's like, Pops, do you actually, he wanted to be thrown clear from the car if he got in an accident. He didn't want to be trapped in the firebox. And I think people
are going to go through the windshield to get thrown clear.
You don't trust him, Grandpa. He says it. That's just how it is. So, but anyway, I think a lot of people are going to be like that with autonomous cars. Now, I want to be in control. So I think you're going to see it move more quickly, with trucking companies just because they're not looking at it from what makes you comfortable. It is what is their bottom line. These things are safer, more fuel efficient, and ultimately are going to cost them less to run because they don't have to pay humans to be in them. So from that standpoint, I think they're going to take off. Now, the larger part, last time I checked, the trucking industry is one of the large, you know, being a trucker is one of the most common jobs that there is. There's well over 3.5 million truckers. There's, I think, close to 400,000 independent operators. When you have that many people that are doing something that they probably love doing, they will lobby and lobby and lobby to make sure that laws don't change that allow them to lose, revenue. Now, I think that, you know, there probably was a time when stagecoach operators were complaining about cars and clearly, you know, we don't have that as an issue anymore, but it's not going to be an overnight thing because we're talking about so many truckers and so many trucks. These trucks, you know, they don't replace them every 4 or 5 years. They replace them, you know, every 15, 20 years in some cases. So I think that it's going to be a while. And I think a lot of what's going to happen is that, yeah, there's a trucking shortage right now. I don't think autonomous does anything to address what's happening right now.
The way I see this working is possibly The same way you have like bus lanes in cities, or HOV lanes, I see dedicated autonomous truck lanes on highways, especially, you know, cross country interstates. If you had a dedicated, I mean, you still aren't going to necessarily keep humans driving out of that lane. But I think if it's just literally a lane full of autonomous trucks, you know, that eliminates a lot of the risk, that mitigates a lot of the risk around people driving and cutting them off and the truck not being able to, account for a human driver in their presence, you know, in the truck's presence. So I could see that, or, you know, maybe even building something like that, like a railroad. Right. It would be like the new railroad pretty much. So you have this completely, you know, empty lane highway that is made specifically for autonomous vehicles. So if we could get to something like that, then I say it's a viable option. But if you're putting these trucks on the same road as people, that ain't gonna work.
Right. And that's what I was gonna say. I would assume that infrastructure would have to be in place long before this becomes a standard. And the way politicians are tripping about this infrastructure bill, good luck.
Infrastructure. And also, like I said, I don't see the 3.5 million truckers that are out there. It's like, so you're saying there's nothing I can do? What if I vote this way? What if I put this person in office? There's going to be so much lobbying for those folks, as it should be. It's like, you know, that's a big segment of America. What is it? 1 out of every 80 people that works drive a truck.
Are we ever going to get, though, to truly autonomous? Right now, there is not a truly autonomous situation where there's not also a person in the vehicle monitoring, right, you know, speed and just making sure everything is everything. So if that is the case, then you still need the driver. The driver is just not actually going to be doing much. And the AI and the systems of the truck sort of operate at their peak efficiency, but the driver's there just in case. And I don't know that any trucking company would want to assume the risk of having a completely driverless vehicle on the road. So I think you still need the driver. So I don't think drivers get taken out of the story. I just think maybe, you know, like Terrence said, you build that infrastructure that allows for those vehicles to be on the road safely by themselves in their own lane or whatever. But then you keep the drivers as that fail safe. You know, and they could be in the truck like chilling, or, you know, doing whatever they do while the truck's doing its own driving. I think it could be a win-win, honestly, if we could get that infrastructure to make it happen.
Yeah. Last mile truckers, those jobs aren't going to go anywhere, because what autonomous vehicles still have issues with is dealing with crazy people that do things that the AI didn't anticipate, and they sit there and they stop. It's not that they're going to have an accident, it's that they'll sit there and they'll just wait until they figure it out. And you've got a lot of stuff doing that, then, you know, it's going to slow things down. So I think that you're definitely going to see, like, those last mile driver jobs, those will be the absolute last ones to go away.
I mean, it could work. We'll see.
It could. So, but like I said,
it's on its way, clearly. Yeah. He has it on his way.
Right. So, and then Stephanie, you had a, you know, pretty interesting story as well about what Apple did with, you know, just disabling cookies and stuff, for lack of a better word, and how much money that's costing all these social media companies. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Apple, you know, if you did your update, back with, I think it was like 14.8 or something like that. There was a part of the update around privacy called App Tracking Transparency, ATT, and you get a pop-up. You got a pop-up when you opened any app asking you, do you want to allow this app to track your data around the web? And you could say yes, allow, or never, or whatever. And apparently, that it's working, because a lot of people are choosing not to be tracked, to the tune of $9.85 roughly billion that social media companies like Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, and YouTube are saying that they've lost in advertising revenue. So the question now becomes, if they've lost $10 billion, what have small businesses lost? Because Facebook's whole argument against this was that, you know, they use the small businesses that use Facebook, you know, almost exclusively as their sales platform, use those targeted personalized ads to find their best customers on that platform. So if you're taking away data, you're not allowing for that personalization, those companies don't get to target the people that are really going to be their customers. So now you're spending more per click to try to find your ideal customer, yada, yada, yada. It's going to cost you more money and be less effective with their, because they're not targeting. So I couldn't find any data around what small businesses have suffered as a loss in the same time frame. But I have to imagine if somebody could figure out that these few companies lost $10 billion, small businesses also must be suffering as well.
I'm making a joke, but maybe I'm halfway serious. I don't know. But maybe the businesses that are losing the most money as a result of this, small businesses, are the companies that their sole operation is hire me to help you run your Facebook ads.
Well. Speak on it.
You know,
I kid, but I'm halfway serious.
I mean, listen,
everybody's got to hustle, right? Yep. So there are a lot of businesses out there hustling on Facebook, on Instagram, saying, hey,
stop spilling that tea, Terrence.
Pay me X amount of dollars. Let me run your Facebook ads. I'll show you the returns or whatever the metrics are. And, you know, you fire yourself. You don't have to manage your own ads, so on and so forth. So maybe those are the ones that are getting hurt. And then maybe the actual small business, we may not see that actual, you know, end result until maybe, you know, sometime next year. Yes. But somebody's getting hurt by this, obviously. Yes. And I'm pretty sure Facebook and, you know, these other companies, Google, they're not eating all that. They're passing it on to somebody.
They definitely are. And it's funny because Apple actually almost got themselves in trouble for this same thing. You know, they're collecting personal, everybody's collecting data. Let's just baseline that. Everybody's getting data one way or another. It's just a matter of whether or not you know they're doing it. And having that information before they collect the data so that you can make an informed decision.
Right. I was, you know, looking at this story and it just reminded me back when Apple first announced this and Facebook took up full page ads in newspapers. And I'm sitting there thinking, it's like, wait a minute, you are on the side of the small business or the small company, but aren't you the one who took away organic reach out of your algorithm? Aren't you the ones who basically started putting boost, you know, boost post on every single time you post something on a page? It's like,
I mean, you can't go on Facebook and just get a true chronological view of your newsfeed anymore. Every post is based on some sort of algorithm. And again, like you said, Rob, you know, you made the bed. Now you got to sleep in it.
It's like, you know, Facebook did all this stuff to take all of that organic stuff away that businesses were using. And now you're complaining that, well, you know, a company whose product is not people, their products are products. We talked about that in our second or third episode. They've actually decided that, you know what? Way too many people are saying they don't like being tracked like this. So we're going to turn it off. And this is something that I've learned having worked in software for the better part of the last 30 years, or close to it. If you are partnering with someone, and I'm using partner very loosely. So in the way that you would partner with Facebook, that you're going to, as a company, and I'm talking about Facebook, you're partnering with Apple in the sense that, well, you know, people who have iPhones run our stuff. You need to make sure that you're actually a partner where Apple's going to consult you on changes that they make in their roadmap as compared to just running you over in the road when they decide to make a change, because this is what happened here. I've always believed this. If you are building your platform on somebody else's platform, you are their product, not Absolutely. Their partner.
Because Apple already has their own advertising business that they expect Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, and at all to participate in, to get featured on their App Store pages and in their news, in the Apple News feed and all the rest of that. So Apple has their own agenda as well. We're not saying Apple was completely altruistic in doing this. And to your point, Rob, about being the product on someone else's platform, I believe this is partly at least why Mark Zuckerberg is so hype on this daggone metaverse, because he wants to be the one. He hates the fact that his software has to live on somebody else's hardware platform. He absolutely hates that. And he's beholden to Apple, Android, Google, whomever, to basically administer his product the way they see fit. So he wants to be on the ground floor of the hardware portion of this whole metaverse idea so that he can control it the way he sees fit, even though he keeps claiming, you know, the metaverse is going to be open source and open to everybody and open, 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 open.
Yeah, once you buy our hardware to get
on. Yeah, exactly. Right. Once you buy our glasses or our whatever, now you can do whatever you want. But he wants a piece of that pie really, really badly.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
So we're to that part of the show where that we all said we were excited about. So we have a guest, and I'm going to bring them on stage right now.
Yes, let me give her her flowers while she's here. Ow. So we have a
Let's go.
50 over 50 2021 list member in the building. Tanya M. Evans is a professional speaker, published author, investor, entrepreneur, and tenured professor of law at Penn State Dickinson Law School with an expertise in blockchain and cryptocurrency, data, technology, entertainment law, and social justice. She also founded Advantage Evans Academy, created the popular From Cash to Crypto, Decode the Future, and NFT Law Guide onboarding programs, and hosts the Tech Intersect podcast, a weekly podcast that highlights new and notable experts at the intersection of law, business and technology. And she does a whole bunch of other stuff, but we want to get right to the meat of the broadcast and welcome Professor Tanya M. Evans to the show. What's up, girl?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
This is
welcome.
An honor and a pleasure.
You
Hello,
are very
everyone.
First guest,
good to meet you.
We are
see you.
Super, super happy to have you on.
Amazing. Amazing. Thank you so much. I love it. And congratulations on the launch.
Woo-hoo. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And so Stephanie just said, you think we're ready to get guests yet? I'm like, yeah, sure. Cool. I know somebody. And she, I want to make sure I put respect on all of your names. So you're a professor, a doctor. A lawyer, you got all these things. Entrepreneur,
doctor of the laws, doctor of the laws. So I like to push two into one. So there you go.
So we are just really happy to have
qualified
you on the show, and we're going to talk about some crypto, some Bitcoin, some blockchain, all that kind of good stuff. So I don't want to keep talking. I want to let you go ahead and kind of just, you know, Stephanie, I know you had some questions lined up, but you got the intro in. Let's go ahead and get into talking about Bitcoin. That's my question.
Right. So let's start at the beginning. You know, let's go back to the basics. Explain it to me like I'm five.
Yes.
Crypto, blockchain, Bitcoin. Let's kind of sort of set the foundation for those three things.
So let's start with, in order to really understand crypto, I always start with just what is money, I feel like a lot of times my education about finances and money has really come despite my 52 years on this planet. Thanks, Forbes, for letting people know all my business, but it's out there, right? So no cracks detected. So I'm proud.
Right.
I'll lean into it. Definitely. But to understand it is to really understand value and think about centuries ago and over the centuries and millennium, there have always been different ways to transact value, both within a community and outside of a community, particularly if you didn't know the folks outside of your community. Mm-hmm. If it's tight and you're making shoes and I'm making clothes and someone has a five and dime at the corner, right? They have the corner store. Sometimes you all know each other in a very small area and it's easy to transfer value even when it's not technically money. You say, I make shoes and you raise chickens and we're going to exchange and we're going to be able to survive that way. Outside of your community, when you don't have trust, that's how a monetary system even developed, because not everybody was trading shoes for chickens, right? And you had to be able to interact in terms of commerce with other groups. And think about all the different ways that we've transacted value. Shells, salt, sugar, and sugar cane, unfortunately, people. So there have always been different representations of value over time. But what we saw governments do is to really create their own type of currencies that they issue, really to fight wars. Taxing really goes into wars and a lot of different things. But cryptocurrency is another way to transact value outside of a government structure. That doesn't mean it is illegal, but it is an alternative form. If you and I agreed that you're going to give me some of your fly glasses for some graphic T-shirts, then we could do that. It's not illegal. It's just not government issued money, also known as fiat. So crypto at a high level, that's just another way to exchange value, but it's not issued by a government. And it's not controlled by private entities. I heard you all talking about private entities before we even hopped on. That's how you think about crypto. Bitcoin is the OG in the space. It was launched in 2009. It's the first type of cryptocurrency. There were other digital assets that came before Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is a game changer because it used a special type of encryption called cryptography, which is where the crypto comes from for cryptocurrencies. And it's a way to secure the money so that you can only spend it once. So think about, at the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, like Napster and Grokster and BitTorrent, which is still around, but a lot of those others weren't. That peer-to-peer technology allowed us to send an MP3 file to 1,000 of our not so closest friends, but we still had the original. You can't do that with digital money. And obviously that would be very dangerous if you were able to do so. Right. And cryptography has a way of avoiding that. So it's a really secure way to transact value without being in a certain country in order to do so. And it's just making it better, faster, and cheaper for you to buy things and for you to trade, for you to exchange, for you to do money transmission around the world. So that's crypto and Bitcoin. And then final point about blockchain. Think of blockchain as a record that is shared by multiple people. Like think of a group text. Even if you delete a group text off of your phone, as long as one person still has the record of your communications on their phone, it still exists. And we're not really talking about the phone companies. That's a whole other thing. But just think if the four of us were texting and I deleted off of my phone, you three still have it on your phones. Mm-hmm. That's a permanent record that makes it more difficult to destroy. And so, you know, extrapolate that to millions of computers maintaining a record. So it's not centralized with any one party. It's not a Facebook thing. It's not a government thing. It's a thing that is maintained by this network of computers. And you actually don't have to do that in order to hold Bitcoin. It's just another aspect of the network that allows computers to maintain that single source of the transactions and the balances at any given time. That's all it is. It's a digital record that is controlled by a network as opposed to one entity, one corporation, one government.
Interesting. Okay. I like the group chat analogy because I read.
You can see it, right?
Bitcoin. Yeah. It's like I keep reading articles. What is Bitcoin? And in the moment that I'm reading it, I understand it perfectly. But then I click away from that tab and it's like, what blockchain again? So yeah, that idea of the group chat, because I hate group chat, so I'll never forget that. The idea of the
exactly.
Group chat, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I like that. Okay, so we got crypto.
And one other thing is that, let me say this one other thing. When people say blockchain, it's as if it's one thing. There are thousands of blockchains, and you start to think of it as, you know, you have the internet, but a lot of times you also have intranets and other people who control things within. And so Bitcoin has its own blockchain. Ethereum, the second by market, market capitalization, Ethereum or Ether, it has its own blockchain. There are some digital currencies that are recorded, their transactions and balances are recorded on an existing blockchain. And then there are some where there's a native coin. So that's the difference between a coin and a token. A lot of people don't use the terms properly. So sometimes people will say token and coin interchangeably, but the real definition, if there's a token that doesn't have its own record, and so it is running its transactions and balances to an existing blockchain. And so that's a slight difference, but Bitcoin blockchain was the first. There are over 13,000 different types of cryptocurrencies right now. We could make one right now just with a short string of software code, and we could create, look, we could create the Tech John coin if that's what you all want to do.
We need to work on that. We should have our own coin. That's what I'm saying.
Let's go.
How would we make that worth something? Is it basically worth something because people believe it's worth something? Is that kind of the gist?
I love the question.
How do you make that worth something?
Absolutely. And that's the right question to ask too. And that's probably the number two question. Number one question is always, is it legal? The number two question is, where does it get its value? And it is driven by the same market principles as a lot of value, supply and demand. Think about the dollar as well. And I always turn that question back on people. The United States dollar has not been backed by gold for decades. So what is really backing the dollar? It's not even fully collateralized. If we all went to the bank to pull out our dollars, everybody ain't getting their dollars. I don't care what type of FDIC insurance is involved. So it's the full, you know, on the USD side, it's the full faith and credit of the government. On the crypto side, it is driven by supply and demand. You've seen a lot of these wacky meme coins that have hit. Oh, I don't want to, you know, disrespect anybody. These very interesting meme coins like Doge, which does actually have value. I think it's like at 28 cents or something like that. You have a follow-on meme coin, the Shiba Inu, that's not even worth a penny. But some people held a whole bunch of them. And as the price pumped and dumped, a lot of people made some money, and a lot more people got left holding the bag when it goes up and goes down very quickly. So that's the supply and demand thing. And one of the beauties of the cryptocurrency ecosystem is that it is driven by community, which actually is a very exciting feature of it.
Interesting. I can see that, but community is so fickle. But I guess that's life. You take the risk. So you talked about the idea of the difference between a coin and a token. So an NFT is a non-fungible token, right? And so now where does that come in? If that's not backed on its own blockchain, by your definition, where does it get backed? And then how does that exist on the internet? Well, explain what an NFT is. I'm just running my mouth. And then talk about how it can exist on an internet when everything is so readily available for download.
And people can screen capture, and people can just, you know, figure out their own ways to download that asset. You know, how does an NFT remain an NFT when anybody with an internet connection and can have it?
Great questions. So in order to talk about what a non-fungible token is, let's talk about what fungibility is, or what it means to be fungible. Fungibility is interchangeability. And I'll use currency as another example. It doesn't matter which dollar bill I have, even though they technically have a serial number on them. It's the dollar is the dollar. It holds the same value. They're interchangeable. A non-fungible token is unique. And also it is verifiably unique because of the technology, the software protocols. So it makes it really interesting to represent a unique asset in the same way that you could represent, before I go there, let me say that. So that's fungibility and non-fungibility. Okay. A non-fungible token is actually not the creativity, but it is ability to represent your ownership of some other thing. So the non-fungible token asset, and we've heard a lot about it in the creative community or collectible community, the creativity or the collectible is referenced in the software code, but it is not in the NFT. The NFT is its own separate asset. NFTs are recorded to a blockchain, and it depends on the type of NFT. The first platform or network to support NFTs was the Ethereum virtual machine. And the Ethereum network is a little bit different than the Bitcoin blockchain, because Bitcoin was really meant to just manage transactions of value without running pieces of code to do something different. The Ethereum network runs like a virtual computer. The whole, I'll use a jargony term, unfortunately, we'll get away from it. The layer one of the Ethereum virtual machine was created to operate like an operating system of your phone or of a laptop, meant to build other things, decentralized applications, smart contract code, non-fungible tokens. And so the Ethereum network was the first to support it. You have others now that are actually more efficient. They might be less. Solana is another really interesting one. You know, of NBA Top Shot that basically did its own thing. So it's not on Ethereum or Solana or any of them. They created their own blockchain to leverage their own IP. Now, to Brother Tech's question, it's an important one to say, let me go with this. So he asks, if you can see an image online, what is the point of representing that you have ownership and control? It's the same thing of me driving up and down Beverly Hills and I could take pictures of a house. That's very lovely. I don't own the house. Mm-hmm. My ability to exercise ownership and control over that house is because I have a deed. So think of a non-fungible token as the deed. So now,
let me jump in there. So could you also sort of make the connection between having the original painting and a print? So if I own the NFT, if I have an NFT of, you know, because I remember posting about the little girl that was in front of the fire, that meme of that little girl smirking in front of the fire, like she sold that for $50,000. Yes. And so basically, you know, if there had been an original painting of that, I would technically own that. And then whoever maybe still has that meme on their phone or, you know, in some whatever, they have what would amount to a print of it. Is that a fair comparison?
Yes, it is. And take it even a step further, that you have a mug that has a picture of the Mona Lisa instead of the Mona Lisa.
Right.
Right. Okay. It's like, yeah. And if that's all you want, great. You have a mug with a picture of the Mona Lisa, or when you're using the reference to a really cool meme or GIF that's out there as well, and a lot of people can access it. But it's the difference of ownership and really as a matter of empowerment, economic empowerment, financial inclusion, both on the crypto side and the non-fungible token side. It's all about ownership in this new Web 3.0 world, all the metaverses and everything. If you don't own things in the next wave of this internet, you are already behind. And that's mm-hmm. why we have a great advantage of, as Black and Brown people, to do this in a way we've not done before.
So if you own it, I'm sorry, Rob, I got you right after this.
Rob was just, he was
like, I know, he was like, but you said something about owning. So if I own this, does that mean I can then license my IP?
Yes. Yes. And it's one of the most exciting things that I can think. I'm an intellectual property lawyer by training. And I do much of my work at the intersection of innovation and IP generally, but copyright specifically. And when someone sells, back to your example, maybe of the Mona Lisa or some other digital asset, when somebody sells that, think of how you buy a painting. Most of those rules have not changed. If I buy a painting, I own the physical copy of that, unless somebody has written it in a document that says I also received the copyright. I don't own the copyright to that painting. But I have the right to display and make certain uses, monetize in some ways that physical painting. And much of that same thing is true in the digital space. When I own an NFT, it is effectively like a deed that connects me to that, that digital piece. It could be to a physical experience or a physical piece. I've purchased NFTs where I own the NFT, the digital art, but also the artist will send me a physical copy that I can, hang in my house. And you see other IP intensive industries. You mentioned, you know, we were talking about NBA Top Shots. Not only will you hold the NFT for some really cool dunk or whatever happens, but it might also grant you special VIP privileges. So like fan engagement is really, really exciting now for NFT holders. It's like holding that golden ticket, only it's in right. digital form now.
That is so interesting.
So what I was going to say, and it was actually about, Top Shot. My sister has invested in rookie card sets for NBA players. All going back, I think her first one was when Penny Hardaway was a rookie, and she's just bought the rookie set every single year. And last year, maybe year before that, she started getting really excited about this. These NFTs that you could get, and she was explaining it to me, and I'm like, "But I already have a video of that. Why is your video of that more?" Or not even more, but why is yours authentic? She's like, because I have the rights to it. I can, you know, I can sell it. Mm-hmm. You can't sell your video. To use the meme, I actually had that meme saved on a thumb drive or actually a hard drive of that little girl in front of the fire. I remember when it came up, I actually had that. I was like, okay, well, I already have this. It's like, no, you don't have the original picture. You just have a copy of it. So the original or the licensed one is the one that, people would actually, get all up in arms about and say, well, she sold this for well over $50,000, which I just thought was like, she's selling something that I've been looking at for 20 years. It's just amazing to me that you can do these kind of things. What I really wanted to ask you though, my real question is, about investing in cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. So I was really lucky. I bought my first Bitcoin all the way back in 2012. Didn't know what I was doing. Coinbase had just become a company. Let's put $100 in and see what happens. And actually kind of forgot that I even had it until, years later. Wait, what's going on? I think I have some of it. Let me go figure out what's going on with it. But, I have been on a soapbox with just, my friends and my family. And it's like, if you would have just taken $100, not a year ago, not 10 years ago, if you'd have taken $100 in April, and put it into this one thing,
right,
it would be $400 today. And it's like, I don't know where else you can, get that kind of return on an investment. The questions that some who think about it will always come back with, well, it's so volatile, which it is. It's like, I would never say, put all your life savings into crypto. You want to be diversified to a great extent. But what do you say? And, I'm talking to my friends and family right now that you should be investing in cryptocurrency. Bitcoin is the big daddy. There's, I think we just went over 18 million have been mined. There's, close to 3 million left to be mined. Yep. There's still some to get. Necessarily you go set up a rig and mine it yourself, but you should at least be investing in it from where I sit. Can you significantly more intelligently than I have tell people why they should actually be looking at these things as investments, as alternative savings accounts? Because you get 1% if you're lucky in a checking account, you might get 200% in Bitcoin over, the last 10, 12 years.
It sounds like you answered her question before you gave her a chance to answer it, Rob.
Look, this is, the professor in me says repetition breeds retention.
There you go.
And we're actually going to have to say this over and over and over and over again, because what you are talking about is a mindset shift. You can tell people all the facts and all the figures, and I do this all day, every day, and it doesn't matter. What really matters is, do you want to participate in the future of wealth? Are you serious about creating generational wealth in this generation and the next? Are you ready to create the type of financial security that jealous white folks can't burn down tomorrow because you have this great town where you're thriving?
You went straight Greenwood on us. Man, I'm not mad at that reference at all.
Right. Because when you really start to figure out, and let's talk about why, let's talk about the economics of it. When I started the Advantage Evans Academy last June 30th of 2020, Bitcoin was around $9,100. The students that did what I told them to do, don't wait to figure this out. This is like looking under the hood of your car and expecting to know how everything works under there. I don't need to know that. I need to know that this car is going to get me from A to B. And if you're willing to listen to people, I'm one of the most highly, I know you all can't tell, I'm one of the most highly risk adverse people on this planet. My lawyer training and just my little only child ways and not wanting to waste money or anything forced me to ask the questions that I'm now posing to you. But what I knew is enough smart people who seemed like they had it going on had figured that out. Enough people who looked like me who were taking a chance. And so you just have to figure out and to bring it full circle. Right now, Bitcoin's at 62,000 per coin, and you don't have to have an entire coin. Start with dollar cost averaging, or what I would call Satoshi cost averaging, because a Satoshi is the smallest unit of a Bitcoin. A little bit over time, set it and forget it. You've done worse thing with $50 a month. And learn while you are also earning. Don't wait until. There is no point where you understand everything so that it's safe to go into the waters. You know why it's safe? Because governments are putting it on their balance sheets.
That's right.
Because companies are putting it on their balance sheets. Because all of the major banks in the world are quietly, I just did a presentation on Deutsche Bank, quietly giving access to their high net worth clients. So why is it quiet? And why is it high net worth? And the fact that we don't need any of that to participate. Right. You open up your Cash App, you go to the last tab, buy some Bitcoin and just let it sit there. And then we'll do another episode to talk about what to do then. But do not wait another minute to empower yourself. Don't be defined by other people. This is something you can actually do by yourself right now, today, if you're ready.
And even without paying, MasterCard just start offering rewards in Bitcoin. So you're spending the money already anyway on whatever you charging up. So instead of getting airline miles or cash back. Get the Bitcoin. Just get the Bitcoin. You know what I mean? Like that makes it easy because now it doesn't feel like it's coming out of your pocket personally, but you are, you know, like you said, accumulating this thing that could be the generational wealth that, you know, our people, you know, have been looking to establish since we got here.
Right. So to piggyback on that,
it's going to
take a mindset shift, and without giving up too information on my family. One of the things some of my family believes is if you get income and you pay your debts, and at the end of the day, when you balance your checkbook, you're at zero, you're doing good, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we are going, as Black folks specifically, we're going to have to change our mindset of money in general when it comes to saving. When it comes to investing. Once we can get out of that mindset set shift, then we can say, okay, you have savings, you have investing. And when you talk about investing, most people think about stocks, but now we can introduce this new thing, cryptocurrency. And again, that comes along with, you know, trying to slowly but surely with repetition, get people to learn more about cryptocurrency, which brings my question is, we've talked about investing. We've talked about trading for goods using cryptocurrency. We've talked about NFTs and using cryptocurrency to own assets and control assets. What are some other things you can do with cryptocurrency besides the things that we've already mentioned? And to give you like an alley-oop, talk about things like staking crypto. You know, what are some other, what are your top two or three things that you can do besides buying, trading, investing in crypto?
Generally speaking, one thing we didn't mention is the nature of Bitcoin and other crypto assets as being a capital asset. And so what was just mentioned is very, very important. As Black and Brown communities have focused mostly on education, high income, insurance, a house, and making sure that you don't, you know, overspend, right? And some type of you know, minuscule savings, but we don't focus on capital assets, which is really the way that wealthy people transfer their assets from generation to generation. Crypto is taxed as a capital asset. So you are enjoying the upside in terms of gains and you absorb capital losses. It's taxed at a lower rate than income. That's why wealthy people don't want to carry a lot of income. You don't have to pay them another cent in their entire lives. They are focused on capital assets. Right. And this is one of the few types that we can immediately get into and secure. To your point about decentralized finance, which is a term, or DeFi, which is a term that's kicked around. I'm the chair of the Maker Foundation, which is responsible for the existence of the Maker DAO. So if you've heard of DAI, the stablecoin, or MKR, the governance token, that's the foundation early on was bootstrapping that. The final point about crypto is that oftentimes some people will spend it. I don't know a lot of people who are spending Bitcoin. If it could be $91 last year and $62,000 this year, I'm not spending it in Bitcoin, but I can let it sit for a while. So you mentioned the term staking. Staking is a way of, think of it as locking it up in like a CD, but something that you know, if you lock up Bitcoin or any other type of cryptocurrency and you can earn a yield on that, some go up into the double digits. I've locked for about 6 months in Bitcoin, ETH, Filecoin, and I think like Litecoin or something like that. And I don't use them. They sit around, so they might as well be making money. Everything in my house makes money, I assure you, including my money. And so locking it up and receiving 2, 3, 7, 10, 12% interest, I've made almost $1,000 in 6 months' time in interest alone. And I will wait for someone to tell me a bank account that pays you that much money, even if you have six, or dare I say, 7,000, seven figures in a bank. What bank is that?
None. And in addition to that, I thought it was interesting, just doing research and getting ready for this show, you know, trying to figure out some questions. Mm-hmm. I thought it was so interesting that not only can you stake crypto for the sole purpose of gaining interest, if you're not going to do anything with it, you can also donate is not the right word, but staking also gives you the ability to use your money to volunteer for other projects, other networks, other things that you believe in.
Yes,
so, right. So if we're talking about empowerment, so if we're talking about figuring out how to get Black folks into this, because we know this is the future, you know, learning just all the different ways crypto can be used, that definitely can be a benefit. Because you can, in fact, use it to build up a community, whether it be digital, and then use that assets to be able to help our community. So I just thought that was interesting.
And one other way is taking out a loan. You can stake it for your own benefit. And so it's a rough analogy, like pulling out equity in a home.
Right.
So that's not a taxable event, and you pay it back and you unlock it and you can do what you need to do, and you don't have to deal with a system that
predatory
has
lending,
been systemically, you know, systemically marginalizing us. So you do it on your own terms.
So let me go ahead, Rob.
I was just going to say, so for the regular person listening, what is the easiest, lowest barrier to entry way to go out and buy some Bitcoin, to buy some Ethereum, to buy some Litecoin? You know, how can just a regular person very easily go out and do that?
Well, the easiest way to buy Bitcoin is currently the only crypto asset available on Cash App, but that's the easiest way. Cash App, if you already have a Cash App account, it's already done what's called KYC AML, or Know Your Customer anti-money laundering a protocol, so that they have your name, you have a bank account already attached. That's the quickest way to buy Bitcoin. Now, the second thing you need to do after you do that and set up some type of regular purchasing is you need to educate yourself. This is a challenging space. Buying it is almost the easiest thing to do. Custodying your own money. We are not used to taking care of our own assets. We are used to giving it to somebody who we trust much more than ourselves with our own assets. And that's a mindset shift. And also it's practice. If you are not organized, you need to get your entire life together, because this is a time and a reason to get organized, because you don't want to leave your crypto on. I did not say one person in particular, but if you know yourself, if you know yourself, because there are many people who have purchased Bitcoin and then lost a device, or there are a number of different ways to custody your coins. There are warm wallets, meaning they are attached warm or hot. They're attached constantly to the internet. That would be like an app or a laptop, a browser. Then there are what we call cold storage, which is not connected unless and until you connect it to make a transaction. That's like Ledger. There are some others as well. So that is an education process. I have a lot of different ways that people can get that, from free 99 all the way up to a white glove service that's 10K, where people have a lot of money in no time and don't want to be bothered with the details. You have to learn the process of setting up your own wallet, transferring off of a centralized platform, or we really haven't advanced the ball. I don't go with Coinbase per se. A lot of things, they are a legitimate site for sure, and they were the first. So it's not taking away from the process itself. They had some issues in terms of some of their employees. There was a New York Times article that came out right before they went public. And I know that I'm going to vote with my wallet. And so I use others. I'm not sponsoring or endorsing others, but I did want to say that as well. But we have to figure out how not only to buy, but to custody and grow it over a long time. That's the part that takes some time. Mm-hmm. So Cash App for Bitcoin, exchanges, there are exchanges like Gemini, Kraken, where you shouldn't buy, PayPal, currently Robinhood, because you can buy, but you cannot take your crypto off of those platforms. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like going into a casino, and you're going to take your money, you change it into their chip, you play as long as you want to, but you have to cash out before you leave that casino. And that's the way PayPal currently is running. Mm-hmm. I think there will be a day where you can pull it off. Right now, you cannot pull your crypto off of those platforms. And so you should be very careful. A lot of people were pissed off to find that out after the fact.
Wow.
I did not
know
that.
So let me ask you, that's fantastic information. I didn't know that. I do have a Coinbase account, because the years ago when I bought my little bit of Bitcoin,
yes,
that was the only place I knew to get it. And like you said, custody and understanding, blah, blah, blah. Like I almost panicked, like I almost did on my own, because I thought I didn't have my password anymore. I was like, wait a minute, where's my Coinbase password? And thankfully I did have it, but I clearly got some work to do. I feel attacked yet supported in that call out. Right?
Attacked and supported.
Attacked and supported, because I got some work to do, clearly, to custody my stuff and figure out wallets and all the rest of that. But I wanted to ask, because, you know, Bitcoin is finite. You know, at some point, I think Rob said there's only 3 million left to be mined. And we don't necessarily need to get in the weeds of how that process works. But once it's all mined, number one, does it still make sense to buy it? Number two, can it still go up in value when there's no more left to get?
That's when it really gets fun. Right now, it's interesting. When you have something that is verifiably scarce, not like the scarcity of gold until we found more gold. So I need to understand that. And we're going up into space, so I'm sure there's gold there. It's fine, right? But we have something that is verifiably scarce. And most of them are already in the world before governments and big business even figured it out. They'll never have all of it, which first of all is the first point. When the 21 millionth Bitcoin is mined, transactions will still go on. But because there are no more, and more people will have found out by then, the numbers, like, this is not legal or financial advice, but in my humble estimation, that's when the roof is blown off of this. Right. Come on, lawyer. Come on, disclaimer. That's when it really gets interesting. Because look at where we are right now. Right. And even when you look at historically over time, Bitcoin launched in 2009, didn't really start getting interesting until about 2014, then 2017, and then we're off to the races, up and down. Mm-hmm. But historically speaking, even when you see Bitcoin in particular pull back, the lows in those bear markets tend to be higher than the previous high.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that, you know, then you extrapolate to the future, right? Now it could all, you know, something could happen that could throw that off kilter, but we have 12 years of historical data of Bitcoin in particular. Ethereum came around in 2014 or 2015, and you have a lot of Johnny and Jane's come lately since that time that have some utility. Like, the questions to ask, what does this do? if it's just like a meme coin and you're happy to trade it and laugh about it and you play with your money, that's fine. That's your business, as Tabitha Brown would say. For me at my house, we want something that is going to appreciate over time or is going to have some utility. Like you have all of these exchanges that tend to have their own coin too. Binance.us, you know, the BNB token. It has its own value, but you get discounts on the platform. Gemini has its own coin. And so they have some value in addition to, some utility in addition to value. And then there are a bunch of coins. We call them altcoins or some other coins. I don't know. My mom, she'll be listening. So I'll keep it classy, but you have thousands of them that are fill in the blank coins and you might want to play with it. But if you're going to play anyway, play with something that's going to appreciate over time.
Yes, 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 yes. And I think we're getting close. I wanted to ask one more question and then you guys open it up.
Thank you, Stephanie. We appreciate your generosity.
I love y'all. I mean it. Should we be looking at Bitcoin adjacent investments as well? Because like I was just reading about those two facilities down in Texas that are right next to each other, that mine. And one of them it was High something. They just went public recently. You know, the power companies are going to get paid off of all of this. Like, you know, should we be looking at these other adjacent industries as good investments as well?
I love that approach because it's a both and, not an either or. And a lot of people have made money on what a colleague, Samson Williams, says all the time. He wasn't necessarily interested in the gold rush that went out to get gold. But for all of those folks who were going out to get gold, they needed a tent. They needed axes. They needed eggs. They needed pots and pans. So anything that is going to support this system, I'd be very interested to look at companies that are investing in the space. Absolutely.
Which is so amazing. And this is my last point, because this is still the ground floor. We've always, Black folks specifically, you know, we felt like we have missed the boat. We felt, you know, no pun intended. Absolutely. We felt like we have missed the opportunity, so much so now that we have to knock on the door and beg the gatekeepers to give us equity, to give us inclusion, to give us diversity. Mm. Please, please, please share your assets, share your wealth. You know, this, in my opinion, is just such a interesting opportunity to where we can blaze our own trail without permission, without governance, without authority. So I just want, you know, you can probably say it better than I can, to just, how can you stress the importance of people specifically who look like us to get involved, specifically because of the barriers we've had up until now?
I think you said it really well yourself.
I appreciate that.
Seriously. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, there's not a lot I can add to that. It's just, again, finding reputable sources and committing to do one thing that this time next month, we can't fool around with a year. Mm-hmm. We fooled around with a year and went from 9,100 to 62,000. So let's not this time next year have that same story where you quote unquote missed out. And it's like, oh, now it's really too high. Literally every year people say the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's making a commitment at this moment in time that tomorrow and next week and next month, you'll be in a better place and be closer to your goals. I actually am, not only am I highly risk averse, I'm extremely private, but I've started talking about my own experiences and how crypto has transformed my life. That this last 18 months, most of the crypto that I've held is because of the paid board position that I have. I'm paid in crypto. So I wouldn't buy more than 3-5% if I were balancing out, and my money managers, I'm insane with the, you know, I probably need to get closer to a 5-7%. Definitely not more than 10% of a portfolio. Okay. But because I was earning it, it just was what it was. And when I first started earning in that realm, they were worth hundreds of dollars. Then they went up to thousands of dollars. That literally transformed my life. So I get to live my life on my own terms. I bought my mother a home this year. And I was using OPM, but it originally other people's money, if y'all not down. But what I realized is the same bank that held all of my assets and thought that everything I did was great for, I've been in my industry for 25 plus years. All of a sudden there were a million questions. They wanted a pint of blood, everything that if I have excellent credit, no debt, and I'm living my fabulous life. If a white man had walked into that bank to present that portfolio, that loan would have been granted in 2 weeks. Right. And it got to the point where I ended up leaving that. I found another place that was willing to do the deal in 2 weeks, long story short. And then 2 weeks later, that mortgage originator sold the loan to who? But that previous bank.
Right.
And I said, not today, Satan. In between meetings, paid that loan off. Mm-hmm. And it cost them more money to set up and transfer. And then they had to give me my escrow back. I bought a home that already was built in equity. I'm not relying on other people. But this is the house that crypto built. Right. I paid off my debt. I paid off my mom's debt. I help other family members. And I am investing in things that are going to be around long after I am. This is the reason that we have to do this on our own terms. And it starts today with an asset that we have access to if we lean into it. This won't be about somebody else keeping us out this time. This is about us.
Yeah. So let me give you a chance to talk about your Advantage Evans Academy and from cash to crypto. Talk about what those two programs are designed to do.
So when I first started it, it was really to everything that we're doing right now to kind of package it up in a way where I can't be all places. I still have that day job as well. And giving my law students my undivided attention. But I wanted to find a way to share this information in a number of different ways. So certainly on a weekly basis, my podcast, Tech Intersect. So please, it drops Tuesdays at noon. Please check that out across all platforms. Advantage Evans Academy has a number of different ways to support people in their onboarding process. And that's where From Cash to Crypto came. So all the questions you all asked me, usually in 90 days, depending upon the program, I have a membership club. So that's $99 a quarter. I know you have spent worse $100 than that, right? Or $365.
$99.
Come on. Right. Okay. Or $365 a year to be a part of the club. Once a month we get on, I do a masterclass. I have some of my friends come on as well. And we teach people how to set up their wallet, how to purchase, how to set up an exchange account, how to move from place to place, how to stake, how to take out loans over the process. And so the monthly membership supports that. And then I have more substantive things as well. So the courses, I have three courses that I offer now. One is the pure onboarding that has me show up live and then 90 days of support with the club. And those are cohorts. So they're a little more intensive. And I have one-on-ones with the people who go through that program. All the way up to, again, the white glove onboarding experience. If someone wants to work with me specifically, that's like a one-on-one $10,000 experience. They're with me for about 6 months and I take them from beginning to end. And we do a lot of sophisticated stuff that maybe, and it doesn't even have to be sophisticated. Sometimes you have money and no time, and it's easier for someone to take you through. They're not interested in going through with a cohort, but most people take either the on-demand course, which you could buy it today, sign up, so $9.97, and that gets you a multi-module, multi-lesson experience and also membership into the club. So there are a full range of things at AdvantageEvans.com. And you can find out more about those things all the way from the membership, all the way up to the white glove service.
Awesome. Awesome.
So,
the one other thing I wanted to say, the other course is the NFT Law Guide course. So the things that we were talking about with the NFT space, a lot of creatives and collectors or investors were interested in the legal implications generally, but the intellectual property aspect. So talking about if somebody is minting an NFT, how to protect themselves, how to leverage their copyrights and other things to protect themselves and to really monetize, not just on that first sale, but downstream revenues, which is really exciting in the NFT world, too. That's why y'all need your NFT and you need a coin.
Listen, we need to get an NFT on our logo or something like that. I don't know.
Let's go.
On coin. I love it. Rob, did you have any?
I was just going to, start to wrap us up. And mm-hmm. Professor Evans, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and school us on some of this stuff. I definitely have learned some things. I'm sitting here taking notes. Oh, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you should do this. I didn't know you shouldn't. I didn't know that you couldn't take your stuff off of Robinhood. I did not know that.
Yeah.
That is a good thing to know.
You should have known that Robin Hood, they suspect from the jump, but that's a whole other conversation.
we'll talk about that another show, but I did not know that. I didn't know it about PayPal either. So, you know, that is good information. Cash App is the way to go. So,
absolutely. I don't get anything from Cash App, and I don't get anything whether somebody buys Bitcoin or not. That's the other great thing. You don't have to trust anybody in this space. In fact, if someone is buying on your behalf, that's when you seriously pump the brakes. I don't want anything to do with custody. I am not a broker dealer. I am an educator trying to get you from point A to point B safely, legally, and confidently. And if somebody is not speaking that game, then you need to walk in the other direction.
That's right. That's right.
So once again, Dr. Professor Evans, this was awesome having you come on being our first guest. We thank you so much for showing up and, you know, and spending some time with us. And as I was saying, I've got like times written down here on my little desk. I need to go clip this. I need to go clip that and just put it, because you've been dropping some nuggets particularly, you know, our family should be listening to this and doing this. It's, you know, the time is now to get in on this. Like you said, it was 9,100 last year. It is 62,300 and something and some change as of right now. I just looked. So it is, we need to be in this, you know, as a people, you know, we should really be looking at this. And once again, we just thank you so much for taking the time. We cannot thank Professor Tanya M. Evans enough for supporting us and being our first interview on the Tech Journal. We also cannot thank our patrons enough for supporting us over at patreon.com/thetechjournal. This week we had a few new patrons: Craig Prawl, Les Green, Osh Park, Kyle Burrell, and Ejali. Thank you once again for supporting the show.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.